of discipline to a kind of disillusionment, a sort of internal despair, which found its compensations only in that kind of reflection which arises from pain. Thus man became more aware of the sacredness of suffering, the sanctity of sorrow. He was re-experiencing the tribulation of Job. He was reaching out for security in which values that were to him apparently hopelessly lost could be rescued. Such certainly was the state of Syria and the condition of the Jewish people at the time of the beginning of the Christian era. Their sorrow, their misfortune, their tribulation can be traced in such movements as the Essenes, the Therapeutae, the Johnonites, and the Nazarenes. Orders of resignation, movements of acceptance of sorrow, movements in which patience had to become important. But it could not be merely the patience of Job. It had to be patience with hope. Patience with something greater than disillusionment or despair. Thus we had, among many of these peoples, in fact nearly all of them, the rise of a messianic concept. For example, the transformation of Taoism in China was due to the rise of what might have been termed new prophets. A Taoist mystic spearheaded this change. A Confucianist mystic spearheaded the translation of Confucianism from a philosophy to a religion. A Hindu Buddhistic mystic and a group of Arhats were responsible for the change in Buddhism. Persian mystics were the ones who brought about the transition in the cult of Zoroaster. And through the Near East, and even through Greece, and to a degree in the Roman Empire, small groups of mystics were the ones to whom, upon whom descended the burden of preserving human hope. Mysticism, psychologically always involved in introversion, mysticism was the natural outlet available to persecuted minorities with who had no hope of the material improvement of their state. Peoples disillusioned completely or nearly so because it seemed that in every way their gods had failed them. The only answer lay in a further re-estimation of self, a further emphasis upon the possibility that the individual had failed God. And the moment this becomes strong, we have asceticism. We also have monasticism. And finally, tremendous programs of repentance. Against this first tendency, a balance of factors was also introduced, consisting of the Syrian gnosis and the Alexandrian gnosis. Both of these were originally philosophical movements that were almost immediately transformed into mystical movements. The restoration of Platonism in Alexandria was Neoplatonism, a mystical interpretation of Plato. Everywhere, mysticism. a contemplative solution to the emergency. Mysticism was also a defense mechanism, because it was the only way in which the individual could detach himself psychologically from the pressure of his time and retire into values which he regarded as essential to his survival. Thus we see that the very pressure of things brought about a tremendous crisis, a crisis like a motion from childhood to adolescence, or a shift from a strongly objective to a strangely disturbed subjective state of existence. Mysticism stepping in therefore required a completely new estimation of eternal values. Mysticism could not attack the chronicle or the annal, or such phases of history as did exist. Mysticism could not disprove Plato. It could not disprove Aristotle. Buddhistic mysticism could not disprove Buddha. Nor Taoistic mysticism disproved Lao Tzu. Nor could these mysticisms rise in violent antagonism against the whole common experience of the race. This was not conceivable. These mystics would not only have been exterminated, but utterly ridiculed, had they departed from those things man had already experienced to be true. So what happened? Mysticism became a new unfoldment, a sequential examination, a penetration into the substance of previous appearances. Thus mysticism became a new explanation for an existing and accepted fact, circumstance, or truth. Your mystic, then, whether it be in India or China or in the Near East, stated firmly that he did not come to destroy the prophets, but to fulfill the prophets. Man resolved to build, turned into himself. The moment he did so, he found a new light radiating from himself to his own beliefs. He began reading his own sacred books with the light of his own experience rather than the light of traditional experience. And in this procedure, began to feel that these books had never been truly understood. He gave them new meaning. He gave them new importance. And as his contemplations extended, not only to the literary phases of religion, but to the creedal and doctrinal aspects, this man, with a great need in his own soul, found the light of his own need illuminating even the nature of deity. Perhaps he acknowledged, and perhaps he never knew, the inevitability and immovability of the divine nature. All he knew was that it seemed to him that he had come nearer to a deity whose essential nature was nearer to the human need. This pattern led to these tremendous motions of reformation. A further demonstration of that is, of course, that in the first century, the Roman persecution of the Christians, though not perhaps as fantastic as we like to believe from a prejudiced point of view, was certainly severe enough to require great fortitude on the part of early believers. These early believers, however, possessed this fortitude because they had moved from traditional focal points to internal, mystical, personal experiences of the fact of God. Thus the deity that had lived upon the Olympian heights now lived more nearly and more really in the heart of man himself. Confronted with an outside emergency, the person was required to turn to the only strength available and achieve what the Neoplatonists termed the victory of self over circumstance. At the first century, the circumstances were bad, the worst that a highly cultured people had ever known. Therefore, the need for this victory was the strongest and deepest they had ever experienced. And out of the impact of the great need and the growing enlightenment of the people, for they had already enjoyed the great cultural advantages of classical civilization, came a new chemistry, the chemistry of the philosophical type of mind, meeting an emergency which philosophy could not solve, and using its philosophic insight to move on to a spiritual perspective. This type of situation, having been widely disseminated, we must assume to represent a valid step in the natural unfoldment of man. When Hegel, therefore, makes the Christian dispensation the order of human love, or man's love for man and his respect and affection for deity, he presented the early Christian with a challenge that was perhaps greater than he could bear. Human adolescence has as its essential nature exactly the same thing. For human adolescence is a motion of the individual from the extraversional processes of growth towards a depthening of his internal nature by which he becomes capable of love, whether it be human love or divine love. Therefore, emotional integration is almost certainly an essential part of man's growth in love experience. So we have an era in which this experience became first a problem, then a burden, and finally an opportunity for an aggressive and excessive possessiveness in the name of love, which was the exact perversion of the original principle, but man himself, in his own growth, passes through precisely these difficulties. Love moves from mere exuberance of emotion gradually through excesses of one kind or another to the final clarification and purification of itself. And that, to a measure, was the problem that faced these six centuries. And to make this pattern solid, strangely enough, the cycle of the phoenix gave the people precisely 600 years in which to achieve their end. For within this measure is the crest, decline, and fall of the Roman Empire, which had become the shelf or foundation which supported the pattern. By the end of 600 years, man was tipped from the final decline of the Roman Empire into what we call the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages begin approximately 600 AD. And dark is an understatement. So seriously deficient were these periods, which we call the Dark Centuries, that we scarcely have a reliable historical record of them. In this time, literacy declined, travel was forgotten, philosophy was lost, and religion was unable to integrate itself into any uniform, purposeful pattern. So the great opportunity which began with the Christian era literally closed or ended with the reign of Justinian, which brought to a theoretical and really factual conclusion the collapse of Roman supremacy. Justinian was one of those who buried Rome. In the very midst of this great 600-year period stands the impressive monument of the Council of Nicaea, convened by Constantine Magnus, paid for by him, presided over by him, and partly recorded by his secretary Eusebius. It is clearly noted that Constantine personally paid the expenses of the delegates, including handsome maintenance in his palaces and estates while they were present. Probably some of the delegates enjoyed greater luxury than ever before in life, or ever again. But the purpose of the Great Council was to prepare Europe for the establishment of Christianity as its dominant religion. In the midst of this period also, we begin to see the difficulties arising. For philosophy had not been totally without experience in these things. Philosophy had always pointed out that there is something more to love than emotion. That there is something more to virtue than good intention. And that there is something more to progress than devotion. With these elements, there must also be a sovereignty of common sense. An intellectual maturity by which the individual not only wishes to do well, but knows how to do well. And in the great excitement of the time, this point was seriously neglected. And out of this neglect arose the tragedy which resulted finally in the collapse of this phoenix cycle. For at the end of the 600 years, the average person had not been able to establish love as a practical force within his own life. He had been unable to separate it from selfishness. He had not been adequately moved to educate it. He had not been reminded that emotion without discipline is madness. Therefore, he was a little mad, of good intention, but hopelessly unfit to meet the challenge. And out of his own unfitness came his own undoing. And his entire purpose was lost when the Dark Ages formed an almost insurmountable barrier separating one world from another. Rome contributed little to the preservation of anything other than the creedal form of Christianity. Greece gave something in its emphasis upon philosophic mysticism through Neoplatonism and the Gnosis. Egypt gave something in the last aspects of its Osirian rituals and rites. But the great danger and trouble was that the individual was no longer restrained in the attainment of certain knowledge. The barriers of the mysteries had been broken. We may say that this break was inevitable and ultimately absolutely necessary. But coming as it did, it was like maturity breaking upon the child. It results in that kind of a situation which may lead to the most disastrous difficulties, moral and even criminal. The strength of the people under these crises depends largely upon the traditional background and the strength of their moral and cultural discipline. This was further impeded by the fact that the Roman attitude changed the level of human progress, emphasizing more and more the rights of the so-called underprivileged group, so that gradually the underprivileged group became the militant custodian of doctrines which it could not comprehend. All of these things gravitate together, and the crisis becomes finally personified, for we discover always in nature that the sorrow of man produces the man of sorrow, that the disaster has within it the inevitable remedy of itself. Emergency must be met, and every emergency produces its heroes. The great emergency converging in these different areas produced outstanding individuals. And in the Near Eastern era and area, this great emergency produced the Christian dispensation and the heroic personalities and leaders of what we know as the Apostolic Age, or the first great circle of devout human beings, following after the dispensation which had been established, becoming the great evangelists of it. Many of them persons whose sincerity and force of character cannot be denied, but whose abilities were in various ways limited. Perhaps the most articulate spokesman of this period was Paul of Tarsus. Obviously, when you cut, as one of the ancient fables tells us, a sail according to the wind, the ship will travel. And the growth of mysticism, or an intensive simplification of religious procedure, was almost immediate. We can again recognize that religion always flourishes in an emergency. Man finds strength to believe in God when he loses strength to believe in himself. When he is no longer able, or believes that he is able, to carry the world himself, he returns it with some proper apology to its creator. But while he is getting along well, he is Lord of all he surveys. Thus, the great critical period resulted in men turning to religion, just as today we have had a magnificent efflorescence of religion following the episode at Hiroshima. Man suddenly discovering an atomic bomb which might threaten his own survival entered into a prayerful mood, and will remain so as long as his scientific progress endangers his survival. In this emergency, he turns back to his ethics, back to his morality, back to his philosophical institutions. In the Near East, the collapse of the Jewish monarchy was one of the factors which had a great deal to do with the local conditions in Syria at the time of the beginning of the Christian era. The unit of culture which produced Christianity was in a tremendous state of despair, of complete demoralization. And yet it reviewed the situation and accepted the earliest forms of Christianity merely as Reformed Judaism. There is nothing to indicate very clearly that even the early apostles viewed themselves as other than the true Jew. The others had fallen away. Their Christianity was true Judaism, the Judaism restored by contemplation in tragedy and despair. They regarded the founder of Christianity as a learned rabbi, a young but remarkable member of the great Sanhedrin, one who supported his own beliefs and ideas in the most approved manner by frequent reference to and quotation from the great authorities of the Old Testament. This situation resulted in early Christianity taking in relationship to Judaism much the same position that Lutheranism took to Roman Christianity. In other words, it was a reform. The way of the reformer is always difficult, and he is not infrequently a martyr, because his reform will not be accepted by all, even of his own people. Gradually, however, it appears that Christianity divided as early as the first century. In fact, the division is already traceable in the Gospels themselves. To one group, Christianity had to be the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. This might well be termed the Syrian school, and has been so called. To these people, as is also pointed out in the Gospels, the salvation of Israel, the preservation of Israel, the restoration of Israel, was dependent upon the restoration of the throne of David. Hence the effort in the genealogies to indicate that Jesus was descended from the house of David and was indeed a lion of the house of Judah. Also, the emphasis found among the apostles, perhaps the emphasis that most swayed Judas Iscariot, the belief that Jesus must be proclaimed historically, dynastically, King of the Jews. Even in this time, even though he affirmed that his kingdom was not of this world, the majority of the persons who followed him in that cycle were undoubtedly convinced that he had come to achieve the restoration of the sovereignty of the state of Judah. Now, this situation was, of course, immediately subjected to another frustration. The martyrdom of Jesus, the scattering of his disciples, led to the inevitable realization that one of two things had to be true. Either he was not the promised Messiah, because he was not crowned with the crown of David, but with a crown of thorns. Or else, there had to be a great and valid meaning beneath his words when he declared that his kingdom was not of this world. There had to be the tremendous transition between the historical Jesus and the mystical Christos, or Messiah. That phase of the doctrine, which dealt theoretically and even practically with the creation of Christian mysticism and Christian philosophy, derived essentially by a blending of Syrian mysticism and Platonic philosophy, this moved into the Greek sphere of influence, perhaps indirectly at least, as a result of the ministration of Paul. And by the year AD 50, there were two distinct Christianities already clearly marked. So clearly marked that it would require centuries before these streams could be brought together. And this, the first really great effort to bring them together, arose in the late period of the medieval epoch, probably the end of the 16th and the beginning of the 17th, to reach its final flowering in such movements as the New England Transcendentalists in the United States. It's a long arc of pattern. But by, as we say, by A.D. 50 and even a little earlier, we had Hellenistic Christianity, which was essentially mystical consolation. The Christ in you, the hope of glory. And we had the Syrian Christianity, which was still attempting to emphasize the Judaistic interpretation of the Christian dispensation. In other words, the Syrian school was moving the faith back into Judaism as a schismatic group or as a reformed group, hoping sincerely to broaden the foundations of Orthodox Jewish belief. The other group finally broke away entirely from Orthodox Jewish thinking, with the result that today St. Paul is regarded as having been responsible for Christianity breaking with the Jewish faith and emerging as a totally independent religion. This in turn means that our ancestors or forebears back in that time had a choice of their religious direction. One was to unfold the Jewish hierarchical system, and the other was to depart from it totally into a kind of wilderness of internal seeking. Both courses were followed. The earliest effort to reconcile them was probably the Gnosis. But by that time, the bitterness between the groups had intensified to the degree that they both turned upon the Gnosis and destroyed that. But when a family feud gets well underway, woe indeed to the arbitrator. He will be the victim of both sides. Moving westward, the Assyrian Christianity resulted very largely in the early formation of the Western Church. The Hellenistic branch contributed considerably, traditionally and otherwise, to the Eastern Church and to the final rise of what we call the Greek Orthodox, which also produced a number of other groups, some of them splinters, and others more or less major branches, including the Russian Orthodox, the Armenian, the Bulgarian, the Romanian churches, distinguished almost entirely by national boundaries rather than by essential differences of doctrine. From the time of the Council of Nicaea, in which an effort was made to bring the two groups back again, to the present time, they have never officially reconverged. And out of the combination, to a degree, of these two groups arose finally the Anglican congregation, which became the Church of England. There is quite an involved story here also, but it is not within our present province. Our purpose is to distinguish as far as we can the valid historical factors which resulted in the year of the Christian era becoming the most important time in calculation for probably nearly a half of the living inhabitants of the earth. Not because they are all Christian, but because they have come under the influence of it to the degree that it affects their calendars, their dates, their chronologies, and all related matters. This situation, being essentially psychological, it also began to move. The gradual persecution of the early church and the difficulties through which it passed in the anti-Nicene period, or that is, prior to Nicaea. Anti meaning in this case prior to, not against. This situation also emphasized an intense segregationalism. The members of the community, not only for defense, but for a certain neurotic need within themselves, separated themselves essentially from other groups and became the basis of a religious motion present throughout the descent of Christianity, which has been called separatism, or the sense that worship means apartness or away from. Probably to a degree, this was due to the dangers and the competitive security offered by remote areas. This, in turn, had its psychological influence. It became more or less a faith of secret worship. And man shall worship his God in secret, and the God he worships in secret shall reward him openly. This thought from the Gospels themselves certainly influenced the early forms of the church. In these days, of course, there was no formal priesthood. There was no essential connection between groups. And the church consisted of completely isolated ecclesias or assemblies presided over by deacons or by persons appointed from the congregation. There was a period in which revelationism played a part, and there were what were called the apocalyptic movements in the early years of the church. The apocalyptic movements dealt with visions, ecstasies, prophecies, appearances, apparitions and phenomena, attempting to prove through various mysterious circumstances the approaching advent or the second coming. Others of these groups went deeper and deeper into their own mystical contemplations, becoming hermits and going back into the desert. Some of these certainly were patterned upon the old Jewish prophets, who were a very remarkable group, completely different from our common idea of prophet, being persons self-illumined, self-appointed, yet generally recognized by others. It's an interesting phenomenon, but all of these things fitted together to produce the gradually increasing pressure that certainly ultimately had to be organized. It had to be brought into some kind of a formalization. While this pressure was at variance with the Roman Empire, under the pagan emperors, it was held much in abeyance. But after Constantine, there was a general discontinuance of persecution. And by degrees, the church began to fall, becoming, for that period, the church militant, or the church composed of aggressive leaders seeking to broaden the foundation of the religion as a moral and spiritual duty. Thus, from this period on, we have great changes. But let's see what happens somewhere else. In India, particularly, the motion began there, but it moved almost immediately to China. We find the rise of the concept of the Mahayana, or the great vehicle, the ship of salvation. We refer to certain parts of a church as the nave. And this, of course, actually means the ship. The Mahayana refers to Buddhism as the ship of the doctrine. And in early Christian religious art, the Christian faith is frequently represented as a ship. and is often so pictured upon what is called the fisherman's ring, or the ring of the papacy. Usually a ship is so represented as the symbol. This ship of the doctrine in India, China, had as its primary purpose the broadening of the foundation of human redemption. Salvation was no longer to be the result of a peculiar dispensation available only to those following certain extreme austerities. Salvation was no longer only for the individual who attained righteousness by his own efforts. Salvation was bestowed, or was a common birthright, and the individual could be saved in two ways, either by doing good or by repenting evil. This became a basic element in Mahayana Buddhism. And within 200 years, the deity Kuan Yin, the Buddhist equivalent to the concept of Mary or the Holy Virgin, had gained tremendous dominance throughout Asia as the symbol of pure motherhood, pure love, and the ultimate forgiveness of sin. For to this deity was given the right to make men whole again through repentance. Prayers might then be addressed to this divinity, who was gradually transformed from a male deity of India into a female deity in China, Japan, and Korea. Thus, the Mother of Mercy came to take precedence over the silent figure of Buddha seated in meditation. Buddha remained as the great teacher, but men did not approach him directly. They sought rather the solace of the understanding heart, the heart of the great mother. They went as children back to the mother. In China, we have very much the same thing. The Taoist divinities began to take on these same aspects. And in Confucianism, love or emotional regard came to be considered more proper than filial devotion, based upon the precedents and formalities of the older beliefs. Thus, the faith of forgiveness became universally distributed. There is only one possible answer to it, and that is that we are measuring events by the internals of things. Now, we might say that if this occurrence of the first century was the only example of this cycle operating, that we were in the presence of a completely miraculous incident, an incident by means of which one important date could be made to stand out as supreme in all history and in all time. We can take this attitude if we wish, but there are certain things which it will not fully explain. One is why it should have simultaneously occurred among entirely different peoples of different beliefs. And the other thing is that this incident should, as far as its essential value is concerned, this representation of an internal motion from one condition to another, this crossing over from a way now past to a way to come, this evidence of a maturing within consciousness, this evidence is repeated periodically. Therefore, we are not in the presence only of one isolated occurrence. We are in the presence of an occurrence that with almost equal intensity occurs every 600 years. Thus, we cannot affirm it to be absolutely unique. But we can affirm with the mystic that it represents a positive growth of consciousness, a step in the great maturing of a creature, a compound being made up of generations, of histories, of cycles, and perhaps even enclosed within the broad pattern of the Eastern concept of rebirth. History comes to these critical focal points, and from them moves forward. The great value of Christianity was stated at the beginning of the era. In other words, the cycle begins with the advent of the teacher. And from that advent on, the purity and clarity of the original revelation gradually but relentlessly declined. The same was true 600 years earlier, when those persons living approximately in the 6th century B.C., Confucius, Lao Tzu, Buddha, Zoroaster, Spitama, and Pythagoras, they formed the great challenging notes for their own people. And gradually these doctrines also declined until at the end of 600 years they had all reached a critical state of declination. They had all declined to a degree in which either reformation must come or extinction was inevitable. Then in this critical moment, a complete revitalization through reinterpretation. This pattern again follows through into the next cycle, where it is approximately 600 years from the beginning of the Christian era to the rise of the Muslim world. And of course, it is this subject which has to be our primary consideration in the next of this series. But we'll never for one moment assume that the rise of Muslimism was an isolated phenomenon. It was not. The rise of Muslimism corresponds almost completely with the decline of Christianity as the result of the conflict of the great church councils, the synods. These tremendous council meetings, continually pressing conformity and orthodoxy, resulted in the continuous restoration of schisms. In other words, every time there was a council, there were more rebels. Every time something was declared to be absolutely essential as an article of faith, somebody said, "I don't believe it." If these constant councils had not only come to some common understanding, or at least had maintained a respectable relationship to contemporary events, there probably would have been no Islamism. For Muhammad distinctly tells us, and the early Muslim historians reiterated, that what Muhammad was attempting to do was to rediscover or restate the twofold doctrine which was the source of his own inspiration. Muhammad unhesitatingly acknowledges that his inspiration is derived from Judaism and Christianity, and that is why he cannot and is not held to be a pagan or a heathen. Muslimism, Judaism, and Christianity are regarded as a group indivisible in essential elements. The reason for Muhammad was the confusion and corruption of the church councils, and the definite belief that he had that these councils had betrayed utterly the purposes of the great teacher who founded them. That already a violent and vigorous reform was necessary, or the whole world would collapse religiously. Now this, of course, was the attitude of a man in an isolated area, Arabia, but no more isolated and no more provincial than that which was the cradle of Christianity. Muhammad had the advantage of the perspective of what had occurred to another faith. He saw many things with the peculiar clarity of a simple man. He claimed no divinity, but he did claim penetration and insight into things obvious. Now the effect of this upon the entire ensuing cycle of 600 years is precisely dated. But we may say that without the church councils there would have been no Islam. We might also say that without Islam we might not have been able to preserve the Christian church. These became ultimately interrelated factors, helping each other even though apparently opposing each other. The church, frightened to death over the ascendancy of Muslimism, began cleaning its own house. And the result was the gradual integration of a united front. In the presence of a common enemy, private feuds were relegated to obscurity. We cannot say that the axe was completely buried. The handle was left out. But for the moment, it was convenient to forget the handle. So we follow this arc of circumstances, the pain, the sorrow, the misery, the disillusionment that led ultimately to the birth pains of a great faith. We follow this faith through its childhood. And we discover that, like all children, it must finally pass from the age of fairy tale, from a strange, unreal world seen through parental guidance, a world of legend and lore and fantasy. It had to gradually face very much the happening that occurs to the seven-year-old child when it suddenly goes to school for the first time. Christianity had to go to school when Islam came along. It had to accept its next experience, namely its adjustment to a pattern of non-Christian peoples. It had to begin to explore the vastness of an intellectual universe that extended far beyond. So we find with the rise of Islam this tremendous motion, and what? 600 years later, this entire motion consummating in the Crusades. The Crusades, which changed Europe, Asia, and North Africa. The Crusades, which destroyed feudalism. The Crusades that gave the world education. The Crusades in which both the Muslim and Christian worlds became sadder but wiser. Almost exactly this date marked the next avatar of the Phoenix. Now the Crusades were not the only thing that happened then, because with them came a complete reorientation of the total perspective of man. Thus this Phoenix cycle presents these periodic emphases and reminds us that there has to be a growth pushing things from within, a growth that moves upon an approximate cycle of 600 years between each of the major steps which it must take, and that therefore this measures the collective integration of mankind on an ascending series of levels. So next time we have to begin to study the world of Islam, what it meant, what it did to Christendom and for Christendom, and how it began the integration of the great systems of Christian philosophy that were to mark the next era, and so on. Christianity went through every cycle of the Phoenix. following its own inception, and must, we assume, continue to do so. So we are not speaking merely of Islam next week. We are speaking of a world, focusing our attention upon the crisis that occurred with the advent of Muhammad, and how this crisis affected every one of us, and still affects us, whether we realize it or not. And so I think our time is up, and that's the best we can do for tonight if you're going to get your bus.